Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. This year, Democracy Now! Is celebrating our 25th anniversary. That's a quarter of a century of bringing you the voices and stories you won't hear anywhere else. Democracy Now! Has always refused to take government or corporate funding because nothing is more important to us than our editorial independence. But that means we rely on you, our audience, for support. Please visit democracynow.org right now to make your contribution and help us stay on the air for at least another 25 years. Thank you so much. Oh, and remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. Wearing two is even better. New York, this is Democracy Now!
I rejected a long time ago that the only purpose of the criminal justice system is to punish.
Voters in Philadelphia have chosen a progressive as their new district attorney.
The most stunning upset.
Sending political shockwaves across the country.
I am a career civil rights lawyer, the only attorney in the history of this city to overturn 800 convictions by corrupt police officers.
4 years ago, longtime civil rights lawyer Larry Krasner shocked the city of Philadelphia by being elected district attorney while vowing to end mass incarceration. The new PBS series, Philly DA, gives an inside look at Krasner's attempt to overhaul the DA's office and the broader movement to end cash bail and reform the probation system.
That is a needless, endless cycle, a cycle of trauma, a cycle of pain, and some of the effects can be irreversible. We just want to give a true, fair second chance, not a second-class citizen, but a fair second chance to prove ourselves and to build our communities up.
We'll speak to two of the creators of Philly DA, as well as a formerly incarcerated activist who now works with the Philadelphia Community Bail Fund, plus a longtime Philadelphia journalist on Krasner's record and his fight to stay in office. He faces a stiff primary challenge next week from a former prosecutor who he fired upon taking office. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, the death toll has risen to at least 48 Palestinians as Israeli forces continue their bombing attack on the besieged territory. At least 14 children have been killed. Hundreds have been wounded. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have killed two Palestinians, including a Palestinian teenager who was shot dead during a raid. Israel reported six deaths and at least 100 injured in Hamas-led strikes. On Tuesday, a 13-story residential tower block in Gaza collapsed after an Israeli air raid, but no casualties were reported as residents were able to vacate the building before it was hit. Israeli rockets attacked a 9-story building in Gaza early today. This is a resident of Gaza City speaking in front of a car that was hit by Israeli rocket fire earlier today, killing multiple people.
What should I say? This is a crime. They were civilians, a woman, her children, a barber, a shop owner. These are the people who were at the scene. It didn't hit a militant nor an official. We're civilians sleeping at our homes.
The deadly attacks come after hundreds of Palestinians were injured in Jerusalem and the West Bank by Israeli security forces Monday and over the weekend, including during crackdowns at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem and over ongoing protests to stop the expulsion of Palestinians from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The International Criminal Court has said recent violence in the occupied territories may constitute war crimes. On Tuesday, the U.S. blocked a U.N. Security Council statement calling for a ceasefire. The Security Council is holding more meetings today. President Biden has yet to publicly address the situation, but an increasing number of Democratic lawmakers have raised concerns about abuses committed by Israel. Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland said, quote, evictions of families in East Jerusalem would violate international law. If the Biden administration puts the rule of law and human rights at the heart of its foreign policy, this is not a moment for tepid statements, he said. Meanwhile, protests in solidarity with the Palestinian people have been taking place across the U.S. and the world. These are two protesters who attended a massive rally here in New York City Tuesday.
I'm here in solidarity with the people of Palestine, who are obviously under brutal subjugation from the occupation and the pointless acts of terrorism perpetrated by the Israeli military.
Israelis, they are going above and beyond, harassing Palestinians. So this gathering today among Palestinian and solidarity people from all different groups of lives, you know, Hispanic, Latino, Blacks, Chinese, everybody here, Arab, Muslims, in demonstration and in support of the Palestinian. The Palestinian is no longer alone by themselves.
India has topped 23 million COVID-19 cases as the nation reported a record 4,200 deaths today, bringing its total official death toll to over a quarter of a million. As India continues to grapple with its devastating second wave, the Red Cross is warning coronavirus cases are exploding across the world and in particular throughout Asia and the Pacific. The group says the region represents 7 out of the 10 countries with the fastest rising case loads. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization says the Indian coronavirus variant has now spread to almost 50 countries, with Britain reporting the highest number of cases related to the Indian variant. The UN warned Tuesday against the crackdown on freedom of speech in Algeria after authorities moved to ban demonstrations ahead of parliamentary elections in June. Ongoing protests by the Hirak movement are seeking an end to the entrenched political establishment and ruling military leadership. The protest movement, which led to the resignation of President Abdelaziz Bouteflika in 2019, resumed earlier this year after taking a break due to the pandemic.
We want independence and the army gang must leave. The army must give power to civil people. People are tired. It's enough.
A French court has thrown out a lawsuit by a French-Vietnamese activist against over a dozen companies, including Dow Chemical and Monsanto, that produced and sold Agent Orange, which was used by the U.S. military during the Vietnam War. The case was brought by Tran Tho Nha, herself a victim of Agent Orange. She vowed to appeal the decision.
La cause est juste parce que la vérité.
The cause is just because truth is on our side. It's for justice. It's for the truth. It's for people more unfortunate than us that we continue on.
U.S. warplanes dumped about 18 million gallons of the poisonous chemical during the Vietnam War, leaving millions of people with disabilities and illnesses, including cancer, heart and birth defects. Back in the United States, the family of Andrew Brown Jr., a 42-year-old black man shot dead by North Carolina sheriff's deputies last month, viewed more footage of his killing Tuesday. Lawyers for the family say the nearly 20 minutes of tape only confirmed that Brown, who was shot in his car, never threatened the officers or even made contact with them. This is Brown family attorney Bakari Sellers.
What we saw on that video was an unjustified killing. What we saw on that video is something that we believe also denotes further investigation and does have some criminal liability.
In Georgia, the three white men indicted in the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old black man who was chased down and shot to death while he was out for a jog last year, have pleaded not guilty to federal hate crime and attempted kidnapping charges. The men, retired police officer Greg McMichael, his son Travis, and their friend William Bryan, also face numerous charges in Georgia, including felony murder. In related news, Georgia Republican Governor Brian Kemp Monday signed legislation repealing the 1863 citizens' arrest law that's being used to defend the three men. The law allowed citizens to arrest another person if an alleged crime was being committed. The men who killed Arbery claimed without any evidence he'd committed a burglary. Arizona has become the latest state to pass new voter suppression laws. On Tuesday, Republican Governor Doug Ducey signed a bill that would remove over 100,000 voters from the state's early mail-in voting list. Ducey signed the bill just hours after the state Senate passed the new measure. Voters who did not cast ballots by mail in two consecutive election cycles will be removed from the early voting list and no longer automatically receive ballots unless they respond to a notice from county officials. This comes as a Republican-ordered recount in the 2020 presidential election continues in Arizona, overseen by cyber ninjas, whose CEO has espoused conspiracy theories claiming the election was stolen from former President Trump. In related news, former acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen is expected to tell a congressional committee today that there was no evidence of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election. Lawmakers are investigating the response to the deadly January 6 riot by a Trump and Republican-incited mob. House Republicans are voting today on whether to oust Wyoming Congressmember Liz Cheney from her leadership role for her criticisms of former President Trump and his lies about election fraud and voting to impeach him earlier this year. On Tuesday evening, Cheney addressed her Republican colleagues from the House floor.
Today, we face a threat America has never seen before. A former president who provoked a violent attack on this Capitol in an effort to steal the election, has resumed his aggressive effort to convince Americans that the election was stolen from him. He risks inciting further violence. Millions of Americans have been misled by the former president. The election is over. That is the rule of law. That is our constitutional process. Those who refuse to accept the rulings of our courts are at war with the Constitution.
A federal judge dismissed the National Rifle Association's bid to declare bankruptcy Tuesday, meaning a lawsuit filed last year by New York's attorney general can go ahead. The judge says the group filed in bad faith. The NRA was hoping to use bankruptcy as a strategy to evade the potential dissolution of the group by New York officials who are accusing the NRA and its CEO, Wayne LaPierre, of financial misconduct. New York Attorney General Letitia James tweeted, quote, "The NRA does not get to dictate if and where it will answer for its actions, and our case will continue in New York court. No one is above the law," she said. Prosecutors are seeking the death penalty and enhanced hate crime charges for the massacre at three Atlanta-area spas in March that killed eight people, six of them Asian women. Robert Aaron Long, a white man, was indicted Tuesday on murder charges. Georgia's hate crimes law was passed last year in the wake of Ahmaud Arbery's killing. This case will be the first test of the new law. In immigration news, the Associated Press is reporting the Biden administration's currently detaining over 20,000 unaccompanied migrant children, including toddlers, across more than 200 facilities in two dozen states with little to no oversight. In at least five so-called shelters, over 1,000 children are being held in extremely crowded conditions during the pandemic. Some of the facilities are run by contractors facing lawsuits and accusations of physical and sexual abuse. The government is also using about a dozen unlicensed facilities, including former military installations, to hold children. Advocates and attorneys are sounding the alarm on the health and safety of the children who are at times detained without their parents knowing where they are. The number of migrant children detained by the Biden administration has more than doubled in the past 2 months as asylum seekers continue to flee extreme poverty, violence, and the effects of the climate crisis, all issues that have been exacerbated by U.S. foreign policy in Central America, the Caribbean, and other regions. And a new study finds nearly 18,000 premature deaths in the United States are caused each year by pollution generated by farms. Animal farming is the leading culprit. Particulate matter created by gases from manure and animal feed, which can mix with other pollutants in the atmosphere, is highly irritating to human lungs and accounts for more deaths than pollution from coal power plants. Scientists say more sustainable farming practices and reducing our consumption of meat would sharply reduce mortality from agricultural air pollution. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, 4 years ago, the longtime civil rights attorney Larry Krasner shocked the political establishment in Philadelphia by being elected district attorney. Krasner, who had sued the Philadelphia Police Department 75 times during his career, was suddenly the city's top prosecutor after running on a platform vowing to end mass incarceration. Larry Krasner is now up for re-election and is facing a former prosecutor who he fired in next week's Democratic primary. Krasner's unexpected 2017 victory in his effort to overhaul the DA's office is the focus of a new 8-part series on the PBS program Independent Lens. This is the trailer for the series.
I rejected a long time ago that the only purpose of the criminal justice system is to punish.
Voters in Philadelphia have chosen a progressive as their new district attorney.
The most stunning upset.
Sending political shockwaves across the country.
I am a career civil rights lawyer, the only attorney in the history of this city to overturn 800 convictions by corrupt police officers.
Krasner is a hero to some and a bum to others.
He's never been pro-law enforcement.
If things aren't working from the inside, you need to bring someone from the outside.
What do you think he's trying to accomplish?
Anarchy.
At this point, there are more people of color in prison or on parole than in slavery at the end of the Civil War.
Larry is bringing in criminologists, activists.
Everything we do, steady fire, heavy resistance. This will be controversial.
Policies that focus on rehabilitation and second chances as opposed to punishment.
We're in Philadelphia, and there's murders and robberies. Community service may be not appropriate.
This DA's office has been too close and too cozy with the Fraternal Order of Police.
How corrupt do you think this city is?
Anybody who's dealt with this office knows there are secrets. We need to find out where the secrets are.
You got to be kidding me.
What is it?
All about police officers.
There has not been prosecution of police misconduct by this DA's office for 30 years.
Right now, Philly police officers think the scales are suddenly weighed down in favor of criminals.
If you're too corrupt to testify in court, you're too corrupt to patrol the streets.
Who was DA when there were dozens of people shot over the weekend?
I was.
We're tired, and we want our neighborhood back!
When you try to make the right decisions, I'll live with the rest.
It's a meaningless, endless cycle, a cycle of trauma, a cycle of pain. Some of the effects can be irreversible.
There's no mass incarceration.
That's utterly ridiculous.
Not one cop is going to tell you that he's on our team.
Well, I suggest you don't shoot unarmed people in the back.
The DA's office is not a place a social experiment should be conducted.
You don't have to destroy the system to get the results you want.
That's the trailer for the new 8-part Independent Lens series, Philly DA. The series was created by Ted Passan, Yanni Brook, and Nicole Salazar. Ted and Nicole join us now. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. This is an astounding 8-part series. Ted, can you talk about why you decided to take on this project?
Sure. Thanks again for having us. I had been interested in criminal justice issues for a long time. Different members of my family have been locked up at different times, and so it was something I was always interested in looking at. I had heard Larry Krasner's name for many years. He had represented a lot of friends of mine who were activists, but had never met him. And one day a friend called and was like, hey, you know that guy Larry Krasner? He's running for district attorney. And it was said, like, can you believe it? Isn't that hilarious? Isn't that ridiculous? And that's exactly what it felt like. It felt absurd. Never did I expect that he was actually going to win, but the campaign itself just seemed like a really great opportunity to talk about the role of the prosecutor, the role of the district attorney, and kind of assumptions that we've always made about what it was, and now thinking about what it could be in something that was totally different. And so it started out as, you know, the idea of like, oh, this might just be a short film about a stunt campaign. And then when he actually won, it was just like, oh, okay, well, this story is suddenly a lot bigger. This is now a story about, like, are you actually going to be able to do any of this stuff? Is change possible in an institution like this? Why or why not? And so suddenly it got a lot bigger, and that became the focus of what we thought was going to be a feature and then turned into a multi-part series.
And, Ted, why do you think that Krasner did win that initial campaign, and why his message resonated with Philadelphia voters. Could you could you talk about when he came into office? Because now you're filming him in terms of the decisions he had to make as soon as he got into office to remake that that agency.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason that he attracted so much attention in the beginning and ended up bringing out, you know, a much larger voter turnout than we had had in 20 years prior, 50,000 more voters turned out in this election than had prior. I think it just shows the fact that, you know, the Philadelphia criminal justice system has just been notoriously punitive for many years. It was just the default. And I think a lot of people in Philadelphia really wanted that change and really wanted someone to be saying the things that he was saying on the campaign trail, but just assumed it was never going to happen. I think a lot of people just kind of given up in terms of the election for district attorney and just assumed that nobody was ever going to come and speak to the things that they wanted to hear, speak about reform in the way that they wanted. I think it just seemed impossible. And the fact that somebody was saying the things he was saying, I think just excited a lot of people who had kind of gotten out of the process in a way or kind of given up. And then in terms of, you know, what we're watching them do, you know, yeah, as you see in the series, you know, they really just kind of hit the ground running. You kind of got the sense from him and everybody in his team that they just could not believe that they were in the office. And so that they were going to do as much as possible. It almost felt like there was this air of like, oh, we're going to be found out and someone's going to like get us out of here. So we better hurry up and just do as much as we can, as quickly as we can. And so, you know, in the series, we kind of follow that and we see, you know, how. We see how the power of the district attorney is huge and has a ton of discretion. There's a lot the district attorney can do with absolutely no check on that power, but there are limits. And we kind of see Krasner and his team kind of run up against those limits in the series as well.
I'd like to bring Nicole into the conversation as well. This week's episode focuses on the issue of juvenile lifers. Could you talk about the significance of that issue and what changes Larry Krasner has promised when it comes to that?
Sure. Good morning, Juan and Amy. It's great to be with you. Yeah, this week's episode looks at the issue of juvenile lifers, which basically has to do with children who are incarcerated for crimes they committed as children. And over the last, you know, 20 years or so, we've seen precedents come out of the Supreme Court based around brain science involving, you know, the brains of young people not being as fully developed as adults, that they shouldn't be held to as punitive standards as adults, that their, you know, impulse control and sort of ability to consider consequences is not as developed in that as adults. So for 20 years, we've sort of seen the Supreme Court move away from some of these, you know, the most punitive punishments, including the death penalty, and up until recently, the possibility of life in prison without possibility of parole. And, you know, Philadelphia is really has been the leader in the country in terms of sentencing children to life in prison without parole. So Pennsylvania broadly and then Philadelphia specifically. And, you know, you see in 2016, there was a Supreme Court decision that basically said, you know, not only can children no longer be sentenced to life without possibility of parole, but district attorney offices across the country actually have to resentence all the children who had been already sentenced to that sentence. And so you see, you know, slowly over the years, DA's offices, including in Philadelphia, starting to do resentencings of these former cases. And basically what that means is, you know, the district attorneys have to revisit those cases, look at, you know, what kind of rehabilitation has happened over the course of the decades or years that that person may have been in prison, and offer a new sentence for the judge to review and accept or not accept. And in Philadelphia, Larry Krasner had committed to, on the campaign trail, sentencing juvenile lifers to less time in prison than some of the sentences that you were seeing. You were seeing a lot of sort of de facto life in prison sentences, you know, a 60-year sentence or a 50-year sentence. Those sorts of things were not uncommon. You know, between the sentences from the prior DA, Seth Williams, and DA Krasner, you know, a study came out that said that their sentences were on average about 10 years less. And so we follow in episode 5, which aired last night, the case of Joseph Chamberlain, who was sentenced for the murder of Sultan Ahmed when he was 15 years old. And you see through the course of the episode, both, you know, Joseph having to go up against the parole board and sort of, you know, make his case to the parole board and the DA's office sort of considering his case and eventually his, you know, his release from prison. And we also follow the family of, you know, the parents of the boy that he killed and sort of they're having to sort of grapple with revisiting that case and sort of deal with the consequences of his release.
I want to go to a clip from Philly DA as the district attorney's team rolls out the new juvenile sentencing reform policies. The clip begins with Bob Listenby, Philadelphia's first assistant district attorney, who was brought into the office by DA Larry Krasner.
When you have a different vision, sometimes it takes new leadership in order to implement that vision. And we've reached that point. Need the opinion of a cross-section of folks that are in this room to really get the policies done right.
I just don't want to have people who are stuck in this entrenched culture to silence everyone else who has come here to make a difference.
Okay, we should figure out why kids are being sent to placement. What do you think makes the most sense?
Overhaul of crossover court would really sort of dismantle some of the dysfunction we see.
It's bad.
It's bad. And the young people end up God knows where.
This is a map, the different locations where youth can be sent in the state of Pennsylvania. You might as well be sending some of these kids to Canada.
Do you think we should use youth or child or juvenile?
I think juvenile has become derogatory, but whatever word you use is going to become derogatory.
We're at a point where we actually recommend our policies to the DA.
We're not asking for random drug screens as a condition of probation unless there's a reason to believe that the child has a drug problem. The metaphor that I have found most useful is the idea of shrinking the footprint, making the system smaller and less damaging.
The ADA should recommend an alternative to detention at the time of any new arrest.
And avoid criminalizing normal, albeit unwanted, adolescent behavior.
So how soon are we going to roll this out and scare everybody?
That last voice, DA Larry Krasner. Nicole Salazar, if you can comment on this and the Supreme Court case. And finally, the critical issues that you felt that you're seeing not only DA Larry Krasner deal with, but progressive DAs around the country.
Sure. Yeah. One last thing that I should have mentioned previously is that just last month, there was a new decision by the Supreme Court that basically was a U-turn from all of those prior cases that I was mentioning that were, you know, limiting the punitive nature of sentencing for juvenile, for children convicted as juveniles. And so now it's, you know, it's while there are 25 states, I believe, that have outlawed life without possibility of parole for juveniles, in all the other states, you know, that sort of pattern that we've been seeing of these cases being resentenced, all of that is now, you know, open for question. Some of those individuals very well might die in prison because of the new case that was ruled 6-3 and had the opinion written by Brett Kavanaugh just a couple of weeks ago. The clip that you just showed was sort of, you know, had to do with other juvenile policies in the office, and sort of what we track in the series is not so much some of the specifics and the policies that they're putting forward, but actually, you know, the tensions between the new guard, between Krasner's team and the existing prosecutors in the office, because, you know, what's part of what's so interesting about sort of trying to track institutional change is understanding that even when you have a leadership change like you did in Philadelphia, that was quite dramatic. You know, this is an office of 600 people. There are 300 attorneys in the office. And while Krasner did fire, you know, 30 prosecutors when he came into office, there's still many people who had been, you know, part of the existing system, who were doing their work day in and day out, who know a lot of the details of the system, who are still in the office. And so we really, you know, kind of used the debate and discussion around, you know, juvenile policies to sort of get at what that tension is and sort of how different people coming from these different perspectives were sort of forced to kind of work together or not work together and sort of see how that unfolds.
We're going to break for a moment, and then we're going to come back to this discussion. Nicole Salazar and Ted Pastner are the co-creators of the PBS series Philly DA. Nicole is also a former producer at Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by one of the people featured in Philly DA, LaTanya Myers, a formerly incarcerated person who became an activist helping people who are arrested to navigate the bail review system. Stay with us.
Gave فتسربت من بين أصابعي كقطرة ماء. كيف حلقت من عشي كفرخ حمام. كيف ارتقيت فجأة من حضن أمك نحو السماء. كيف تسربت من بين أصابعي كقطرة ماء. كيف حلقت من عشي كفرخ حمام. كيف ارتقيت فجأة.
The Weeping of the Rose by Rimbana. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The fourth episode of Philly DA focuses on probation and parole. Philadelphia DA Larry Krasner refers to it as, quote, mass supervision, the evil twin of mass incarceration. The episode tells the story of LaTanya Myers, a formerly incarcerated person who becomes an activist who helps people who are arrested with navigating the bail review system. In this clip, Myers addresses a Pennsylvania State Senate hearing on probation reform.
Within the last 18 months, I was able to start school, start community college. I apologize, I'm a little nervous, but I was able to find my voice and become an advocate, to be a part of the solution and not the problem. I think when it comes to true probation reform, we have to start with the reform of the culture in the probation department. I mean, a culture in a probation department is not one that's encouraging. It's not empowerment. When I got on probation, all I was told was I have to come in here weekly and report. I was looked at as high risk because of an algorithm that no matter what I accomplished till 2027, it would never change. That is a meaningless, endless cycle, a cycle of trauma, a cycle of pain, and some of the effects can be irreversible. We just want to give a true, fair second chance, not a second-class citizen, but a fair second chance to prove ourselves and to build our communities up. Thank you.
That's a clip from Philly DA of activist LaTanya Myers testifying about probation reform. This is another clip featuring LaTanya.
I'm getting ready to go to the probation office. Depression is everything. Because all they know is what they reading on that paper. She don't know who I am for real. So, gotta make a good impression. She got my life in her hands. I make the wrong impression. She might make the wrong decision or the wrong assumption, you know? For a relationship, you can walk away. You can't walk away from this. It was a couple days after my 12th birthday. I woke up that morning and my mom's boyfriend had took her bed and dragged it all the way down the steps. He was out of control. I thought that I could protect my mom. And I picked up like an air freshener can and I hit him with it. He went to a payphone, called the police. When I seen the cops, I thought that they would understand what was going on. I was charged with aggravated assault in the first degree.
Next stop, take me home.
That was the first time I ever was in jail. For 3 days, I didn't know where my mom was at. I didn't know if any of my family knew where I was at. I was just there. And I would cry so hard. Finally, my lawyer pulled me to the side and she says, your grandmom's here. You take this probation,
you go home with your grandma today, or go back to jail for another 10 days to fight this case. I chose to go home with my grandma. I'm 29, and that first felony from when I was 12 years old is what it brings up time and time again. My only felony on my record that I shouldn't even have.
That's LaTonya Myers in Philly DA, the PBS series that's airing now. LaTonya joins us now. She is support coordinator for the Philadelphia Community Bail Fund, also the founder of the organization Above All Odds. Still with us, Nicole Salazar, co-creator of the PBS series Philly DA. LaTonya, welcome to Democracy Now! The figures are absolutely astounding. You have Philadelphia as the second most supervised state in the country after Georgia. New York has 12,000 people under probation and parole. It's six times larger than Philadelphia. Philadelphia has 40,000 people under probation and parole. Your story tells the story of what so many people are going through. If you can take us from those clips to why you became an activist on this issue, why you think it is a critical civil rights issue in this country right now.
First, I just want to say thank y'all so much for allowing me to be on this segment today and talk about these issues that impact us so greatly. When we talk about probation and parole, that is the streamline to mass incarceration. And the reason, you know, I was inspired in being an advocate, I found my purpose through my pain. You know, I was arrested. I didn't know what advocate or activist was until I started to raise the voices of our concerns and learned that it was a community of organizers. It was a community of people that understood that and explained to me that this was systematically happening on purpose. So I just wanted to lift up those voices of those that wasn't being heard, to let people know that we're closest to the problem, so we're closest to the solution. We don't no longer will allow anyone to tell us that, you know, we can't and won't change if given an opportunity, nor conform to the negative stigmas that's attached to us as returning citizens. So this work has become my life and my purpose to help others.
And LaTonya, a lot of people are not aware how the parole and probation system works in terms of mass incarceration. In Pennsylvania, more than half of the people admitted into the prison system are as a result of violations of probation or parole. What's been done to attempt to reform that system?
So there have been many attempts, you know, statewide attempts, bipartisan efforts. I know that the Defenders Association of Philadelphia has filed 1,700 early termination petitions, 85% of them, which has been individuals have been granted early termination. But this is on a case by case basis. You know, we need something more robust, more statewide on caps. In Philadelphia, a judge can sentence you until you cease to live on this earth to be on probation and parole. 20 and 30 plus year sentences for probation and parole. And I think that needs to stop. So I am happy to hear the efforts that the Defenders Association is doing, but particularly the efforts that grassroots organizations and impacted people are doing to let individuals know that we want to be a part of this conversation. We need to be a part of this change. We need to allow people to know that our narrative of what it is, we just want to be citizens. We want to be heard. We want to be uplifted. We want to be supported and endorsed like everyone else. In order for us to be successful, that we need people's support and understanding that we just want a part of the American dream, but it hasn't been American dream for us. It's an American nightmare.
Nicole Salazar, in the film, Larry Krasner says 1 in 14 African-American Philadelphians are under probation or parole. And the significance of what not only the DA's office is doing, but trying to pressure judges.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think probation and parole is one of those areas where you really see how you know, the DA has a lot of discretion and a lot of power, but also a lot of limits on what they can do. So one of the main drivers of excessive supervision in Pennsylvania is actually state law, sentencing laws that are formulated in such a way that you have basically a minimum and a maximum. So you can be sentenced, you know, to a 5 to 10 year sentence in Pennsylvania, whereas in another state, you might be able to get a flat, you know, 4 year sentence, 4 years in prison, and maybe, you know, some probation on top of that. But in Pennsylvania, because it's always in this, you know, formulation of X to 2X, you automatically, you know, if you're released after your minimum of 10 years, you're going to then serve that same amount on parole. So that would be 10 years in prison, 10 years on parole, then possibly plus an additional probation sentence on top of that. So that's sort of baked into Pennsylvania law. And so that's something that, you know, on a local county level in Philadelphia, you cannot change. But what they do have discretion over is more of the probation tail that is assigned. And they've, you know, made efforts. What you see in the film is basically, you know, a two-pronged effort of what they're trying to do. One is for cases going forward that they're trying to limit overall supervision, so parole plus probation, to 3 years for felony cases and an average of 18 for misdemeanor cases. And so, you know, they have a tremendous amount of discretion there because, you know, nationally, 95% of all criminal cases are resolved through negotiated pleas. And so a negotiated plea basically means the prosecutor and the defense attorney come together with, you know, with a proposed sentence that they then present to the judge. And for the most part, judges will accept those pleas because, you know, if they didn't, if every case had to go to trial, and you hear this in the film and people say it all the time, you know, the system would literally collapse if all of those cases, thousands of cases coming through the system every year that are being handled by 60 odd judges in Philadelphia, if they all went to trial, the system would collapse. And so there's a lot of pressure on the judges to accept those negotiated pleas. So that's kind of where that discretionary power really comes into play. But the other part of what they're trying to do, and this is where you see a lot of pushback from the judges in the film, is that they would like to, on a large scale, revisit so many of those 40,000 people who are on probation or parole in Philadelphia who are doing well. And like LaTanya was saying, have them terminated early from that probation. And here's where you really sort of need cooperation between the judges and the DA's office and the public defender's office, because what they were hoping to do was sort of, you know, look on sort of like a broad data scale and see, you know, how many people do we have on probation? How well are they doing? Are there people that, you know, just with the signing of a pen where we could just sign the forms and get a lot of people off probation at once? But what you see basically is that the judiciary does not want to move that quickly. They still are, many of them very married to sort of this idea that being on probation is actually, you know, pro public safety, even though there are a lot of there's a lot of compelling evidence that actually shows, you know, why actually being on probation can be criminogenic just because of all of the hurdles that are put before somebody to be on probation and still be able to maintain other aspects of their life, their job, their family. And so you see in the film that the judiciary is not really ready to take this step. They're not able to do it on a broad scale. You know, there was hope at some point that even LaTanya's case might possibly be included in sort of these mass petitions they were trying to do, but that doesn't go forward. And there are, I think, 9 judges at the time of the end of that episode who do say, okay, we're going to do some, you know, mass early terminations just in terms of our individual lists. And that process is still ongoing, but it wasn't as robust a process as they were hoping for.
LaTanya, if you can talk about your own organization Against All Odds and what you're hoping to see right now, and if a progressive DA like Larry Krasner, who's up for re-election, really does make a difference in Philadelphia, what does it look like to you working with so many people on probation and parole who are captured by the system?
Well, I just want to say thank you for that question. And I think when Nicole brought up a good point, all through this episode, you hear the judges saying, we don't want them to break the system. They're going to break the system. Well, the system needs to be broken and abolished in order to restore and heal our community, because it's breaking us apart. It's tearing our families apart. And, you know, I just hope that our community continue to be civically engaged. I hope that people look at this film and be inspired to know that they can, too, advocate. They can go to their local representatives. They can advocate for themselves in the courtroom. We have to know that we have the power to uplift the voices to make the impact that we need. You know, we have to depend and understand that we are the force that makes the power. We can't put it in one person's hand. But what we can do is make sure that our voices are heard and our narratives are correct. And that is that we want to bring hope and healing back into our community, not any harm. So I just want to say thank you to all the people that was able to support me in the community. And I want others to support other people. And I wanted my organization to be able to support people to have those resources, to have that community impact. When people go in those courtrooms alone, they don't have to do it alone. You know, we have a community of people that can correct this narrative that's trying to get depicted on us to keep us entangled, further entangled into the system. So I just think, you know, the film crew and everyone for allowing me to have this opportunity to inspire. I want individuals that's held on probation and parole to stay strong, to understand that you can get off, that we are fighting, that you are not your worst mistake. If I did it, you can do it. Any support that I had, I want people to be able to galvanize the support around individuals that's currently going through it. We have people that have, you know, lost their life, lost their job, lost family members while we're slowly waiting for the system to turn, change and be more compassionate and uplifting. They spent $344 million on incarcerating individuals in Pennsylvania for technical violations. And that they didn't even catch a case. If we take a percentage of that and reinvest it into addressing the issues as to why individuals can't make it to their probation appointment on time, why is it hard for them to find housing when they're discriminated on housing applications for employment? If they can't, if they're boxed out of, you know, opportunities to climb in careers, if they boxed out of opportunities to live, you know, in better neighborhoods, or even boxed out of opportunities to get Pell Grants to go back to school, how can they really think, you know, we're going to be able if we're not really able to be in amongst our communities with the same resources, with the same opportunities of others? Right now in Philadelphia, the commissioner is requesting $750 million for the police budget. $750 million that right now she's testifying and asking our city council to allot this for the budget. There's not a percentage. How much is going to take for us as a community to reinvest into the problem and not locking us up, you know? And that's what we just ask for as a community, for people to allow us to be in these spaces and talk about the resources that we need and that's most helpful. And I want individuals to be uplifted, specifically individuals that's people of color in the LGBT community. I want them to know that we exist, you know, that we are fighting and that you are heard and that you're not alone, and that you can do the same thing that I did with the community support. And let's keep focused on civic engagement and individuals finding their voices and sitting at the table of power and speaking truth to that power.
LaTanya Myers, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Formerly incarcerated person who became an activist to support others going through the system, support coordinator with the Philadelphia Community Bail Fund, founder of the organization Above All Odds. And thanks to Nicole Salazar, co-creator of the PBS series Philly DA. When we come back, we look at how DA Larry Krasner faces re-election next week in Philadelphia's Democratic primary. Stay with us.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can.
Wake Up Everybody by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner is now fighting to stay in office. Next week, he faces a challenge in the Democratic primary by Carlos Vega, a former homicide prosecutor who was one of the three dozen veteran prosecutors fired by Krasner when he took office in 2018. During a debate last week, Vega criticized Krasner's record and blamed him for a spike in murders and shootings in Philadelphia.
We don't need to make a choice between reform or safety. We need both. We deserve both. Mr. Krasner, you have blood on your hands. Milan Longcar, a young man walking his dog. Trevon Register, 6-year-old boy beaten to death. Samar Jones, 7-year-old boy killed on his porch. Corporal O'Connor, killed in the line of duty. Gladys Coriano, a domestic violence victim, shot in front of her house. Dominic Bila, young man shot in the Franklin Mills Mall. These are just a few of the victims that we can directly put on the incompetence of Larry Krasner.
In response to Carlos Vega, incumbent DA Larry Krasner defended his first term, saying he's followed through on his promise to reform Philadelphia's criminal justice system.
First of all, we have a crisis with shootings. It is with fatal and non-fatal shootings. And the truth is that we have a nearly 85% conviction rate with those cases. That is among the very highest in 5 years. It is comparable to other cities in a very favorable way. It's a very high rate compared to other cities. And we did it without cheating. Part of the reason we've had 20 exonerations is we were dealing with an office when my opponent was there where the truth didn't matter. And so if you could convict someone, you convicted them. It might be the wrong person. They might sit in jail for 20 years or 25 years. That didn't get us anywhere. What we have to do is we have to bring things that work, and we've done that.
For more, we're joined in Philadelphia by investigative journalist Lynn Washington, who's covered the city's criminal justice system for decades, recently wrote a column for WHYY headlined, "Krasner's stance on Mumia won't cost him re-election, but it will stain his reputation as a reformer." Still with us, Ted Passan, co-creator and director of the PBS series Philly DA. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Lynn, if you can talk about the scope of this race, what it looks like. Of course, his opponent in the Democratic primary is supported by the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police.
And I think that endorsement by the FOP for the challenger of Larry Krasner, Mr. Vega, is very telling. The FOP represents the very worst of regressive approach to the criminal justice system, the very elements that Mr. Krasner is trying to reform. And here is Mr. Vega, who's claiming that he's different, aligning himself with the very ideology as well as individuals who have created the problems that we now have in the city of Philadelphia, where we have a justice system that is not operating in a just manner. The prime ethical mandate for prosecutors is to seek justice, not convictions. And this has been a part of Pennsylvania case law since 1889, when a Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision came down that enunciated the role for prosecutors is justice.
And Lynn, first of all, greetings. We haven't spoken in quite a while. We were former colleagues at the Philadelphia Daily News many years ago. I wanted to ask you this whole approach that some people are saying, well, Krasner, crime has risen and violence has risen during Krasner's time in office, when the reality is all across the nation, there have been spikes in crime in many cities. And some people, myself included, believe that we're actually witnessing a national police slowdown that is occurring across the country as police are chafing at the attempts to control the way that they mete out abuse of citizens. I'm wondering your sense of will this stick on Krasner, that he's responsible for the rise in crime and shootings in Philadelphia?
Well, the reality is, yes, he's been assigned that label, and assigned that label falsely. From the day he stepped into office, the Fraternal Order of Police and persons like his challenger, Mr. Vega, have said that Larry Krasner, crime is going to be off the charts. You have to watch out for him. This reform is going to make people unsafe. Not true. As you've indicated, their crime has gone up across the country. And as crime has gone up, there's been an appreciable decrease in policing. In Philadelphia, a vast majority of the crimes, and particularly homicides, are unsolved. And if the police are not making any arrests, then prosecutors can't prosecute the cases. So it is intellectually improper to say you're not prosecuting homicide cases when, in fact, the police are not bringing the cases to them. And according to Mr. Krasner, the cases that are brought to him are fraught with lack of evidence. And if Krasner is trying to do something different from what was the policy and practice of that office for decades, where they would just go in irrespective of incongruities in evidence, they would just put people in prison. That's their job. That's wrong. And that's what Larry Krasner's been fighting against. Yet he has been, quite frankly, he's been tarred by not only the FOP, but conservative politicians, and even during his time in office, the then U.S. attorney in Philadelphia was very critical of the reforms. And this is a person who is the chief enforcement officer for the federal government, should not have been taking that kind of a posture. Yet you have to understand the context. He was with the Trump administration, where a president openly endorsed brutality in the name of law and order.
And Lynn, I did want to ask you about a criticism that you've had of Krasner, his handling of the Mumia Abu-Jamal case, arguably the most famous prisoner worldwide, U.S. prisoner worldwide. You conducted more than 10 years ago a ballistics test. And I think Ted Passan actually filmed that in yes. terms of raising real questions about what happened with the evidence in the Mumia Abu-Jamal case. Can you talk about your criticism of Krasner and his failure to act on this case?
Well, the column laid out that Mr. Krasner has done what his predecessors have not done, and that's seek justice. Thus, he has reversed the convictions of about 20 people so far. There's a vast number more that should be, but you have to give him credit for what he did. In each of those instances, there have been very clear and compelling evidence of misconduct, not only by police in the initial investigation, but prosecutors, and how in many instances they persecuted the cases. Now, how does that apply to the Abu-Jamal case? The evidence that led Krasner's office to seek reversal of convictions for 20 people so far, commendably, is far less than the evidence of misconduct by police, prosecutors, and judges in the Abu-Jamal case. So if you are a reformer, as Krasner is, then it's easy to take on certain cases, but the real defining line is when you take on the hard case. Reality, there is an institutional bias against Abu-Jamal that goes from the police officers on the beat in Philadelphia all the way up through the justices on the Supreme Court of the United States. So that was the essence of the column, that when you look at the evidence that is supposedly underlying Abu-Jamal's conviction, you see gross errors in there, and you don't need a law degree or a PhD to see those, one of which is what you just mentioned, the bullet test that we did. According to the prosecution, Abu-Jamal straddled the officer that he was convicted of killing, shooting downward four times, only hitting the officer once. If, in fact, it happened that way, then you would see bullet marks in the sidewalk. In all of the crime scene photos that were produced in court, there were no bullet marks. We, in fact, took those crime scene photos, sent them to a person at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory whose job is to enhance photos from deep space, you know, like Saturn and Uranus way out on the end of the solar system. That person analyzed these photos with a supercomputer and found no bullet marks. So if there's no bullet marks from the scenario of Abu Jamal shooting those bullets, then that just is, you know, one exhibit A of the errors in that case.
Lynn Washington, we're going to have to leave it there. But I want to thank you so much for being with us, and also Ted Passan and Nicole Salazar, directors and producers, co-creators of the PBS series Philly DA, now airing nationally and online. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.